Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Big news in Washington today. The Speaker of the House, the third most powerful person in Washington, some would say the second, he's third in line to the presidency, president, vice president, Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has said that he will resign. And he's not resigning, he's not serving his term and then resigning. He's resigning this October. What is going on here? Is it because of the Republican threat to shut down the government and the fact that the Tea Party wing has always been giving John Boehner intense migraine headaches? Or does it have to do with something else? We're going to discuss that. And also the Pope in Washington, discuss the pontiff's visit, the speech he gave on the floor of Congress, both the political reaction and, frankly, the religious reaction. What is the proper role of religion in politics? To help discuss these matters, I've invited as my guest Mike Lane. Now, Mike Lane is the president of Intellifence Strategies. He is a Republican strategist. I figure who best to comment on John Boehner than a Republican, but also he's a practicing Catholic, and so I think it's good to get a conservative's view on the Pope's visit. There won't be any calls today. It's because we're going to have a nice conversation, just Mike and me, but don't worry, we'll have a regular call-in show on Monday, and if you have any comments, save them or post them on the website at marklevinetalk.com. So first of all, Mike Lane, welcome to my radio show.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mike and I have debated on TV for many, many years. I think this is his first time in the Center for American Progress. I don't know how that feels for you. I was at the Western Conservative Summit in Denver a few months ago. Probably there's a similar feeling, like you've walked in to, I don't know, foreign territory?
Actually, it did feel like foreign territory, but I was very impressed. Nobody had two heads. Nobody had four arms. It was sort of a normal-looking crowd.
Yeah, we hide those people, don't you know that?
Okay, that's good.
Let's talk first about John Boehner, because it is the breaking news. Now, John Boehner has long had trouble dealing with the right wing of his party, including a wing that wanted to shut down the government. Yet again, John Boehner's had one shutdown under his tenure, one almost shut down, came 6 seconds apparently from shutting down the government. This time it was supposed to be about Planned Parenthood. And what John Boehner normally has done in these situations is he grits his teeth and gets his group of Republicans to vote with the Democrats to get things done. That doesn't endear him to the right wing. Is this something that he feels he's kind of forced to do?
I don't know, Mark, that he feels like he's forced to, as much as maybe he's just sort of taken a page out of Johnny Paycheck's song and just take this job and shove it.
He just doesn't like it.
You know, it's a thankless job. It does have its rewards, but it's a thankless job. And there are a number of members of the Republican Conference who don't appreciate the job that Speaker Boehner has done. They have mistakenly, in my view, dedicated their terms in office to making life more difficult for the Speaker and making more life more difficult for the Republican Party than they do in making life more difficult for Nancy Pelosi.
Right. It seems to harm your party. Here it is. Their goal is to, I guess, win conservative primaries. Gerrymandered districts tend to have a very liberal and very conservative people in them. And yet when they fight to shut the government down, the Republican leadership, and it's not just John Boehner, it's Mitch McConnell as well, seem to feel that that harms their party more than the Democrats, and frankly has done so ever since Newt Gingrich shut down the government for, I don't know, a year under Bill Clinton?
Well, couple things there. First of all, I don't think anybody in the what we call the House Freedom Caucus, that's what they call themselves, they're not out to shut the government down. What they're out to do is advance a more conservative agenda. And in my opinion, they mistakenly believe that by being more confrontational, more threatening on the whole issue, that they will get President Obama to back down and cave into their demands. I think that if you look at the average member of the House Freedom Caucus, they're relatively junior members of Congress. They haven't been around. They don't have the experience. They don't have the perspective. They haven't really matured and grown into the job the way somebody else has, the way the majority of the House Republican Conference has. And unfortunately, there's just enough of them by like one or two that if they vote together as a block, they can bring the Republican conference vote under the magic 218. So they do wield an outside outside sense of power or an outside perspective of power. But that's the way politics work. And it's up to the speaker and his leadership team to figure out how to keep them on the team and not have them outside the tent.
So the tail wags the dog. What I don't understand is the Republicans did very well in 2014, really a landslide victory.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there are more Republicans leading the House than at any time in, I don't know, 50, 60, 70
years. In a long time.
Probably since the 1920s.
Modern history.
Probably since Herbert Hoover. Why aren't there enough establishment Republicans to overvote the renegades? Why are there...
Well, you know,
what's going on with your party? Your people are supporting Donald Trump, too. What's going on with the Republican Party these days?
I think it's a fairly diverse caucus, and I think that's a good, healthy thing. Ultimately, I believe it's a problem that after the internal battles are fought, that after you come out with a conference position, that you have just enough by one or two votes of people who don't accept the fact that the conference has decided to move forward in a particular direction. That's a problem, I believe, of maturity. It's a problem of lack of experience. It's a problem of lack of growing into the job. And it's a problem of taking your eye off the ball. You know, we want to get from point A to point B, point B being a more conservative policy position. But yet the members of the House Freedom Conference want to be there yesterday, and they're not willing to invest the hard work that doesn't include instant gratification that is going to get us there over 4, 8, 12, 20 years.
The general rule in legislation is it's kind of the same rule when you elect the speaker. Yes, at the end of the day, the speaker is elected by the entire body of Congress. But if the Republicans were to split their vote, for example, Nancy Pelosi would be the speaker. So they work at their own caucus. They decide. They fight amongst themselves. They choose a person, and then they all vote as a block for what used to be John Boehner, although, as I recall, one or two didn't even vote for him in the final vote.
Last time around, there were actually it was a dozen that didn't, and you know, I still don't think they had enough votes now to oust him in the current discussion. John Boehner was always going to be able to get his budget through. The recalcitrants were always going to oppose him, and they were going to oppose him loudly. But at the end of the day, he was going to be victorious.
But so you would say then Boehner represented 60% or so of the Republicans?
No, Boehner
represented
about
70, 80?
Yeah, 80 to 85%.
Okay. But that 85% was never enough to get things done.
Two votes.
It was not 218.
It's two votes. It's about 215, 216.
It's that close.
Yeah.
And yet they couldn't get two, three Republicans to budge over the line. I remember when Tom DeLay, as you know, I used to work in Congress, Mike, and when I was there, Tom DeLay was known as the hammer. He was the majority whip, but for all intents and purposes, everyone considered him the speaker. He tended to have more power, actually, than the speaker. In any case, I remember one late night session when a Republican from Eastern North Carolina, you may remember his name, it escapes me at the moment, who represented a lot of the textile industry. And Tom DeLay needed him to vote against his district. He needed him to vote to raise taxes on the textile industry for whatever reason. I don't remember the reason. And this guy was literally crying on the House floor. Apparently, the way it works is you're supposed to vote in 30 minutes, but they can hold the vote open. And this vote had been held open for 6 hours. And there's this guy crying on the floor as Tom DeLay is not physically, but I'm sure mentally twisting his arm until he finally voted against his constituents and then promptly lost his race the next year. What is it that Tom DeLay had with, frankly, fewer members of Congress that John Boehner doesn't have?
Well, first of all, Tom DeLay was the whip, and John Boehner is the speaker. It's not his job to round up votes, although he'll certainly participate in it. The whip is a guy named Steve Scalise. Now, he's from Louisiana, and he was specifically elected this last time around. He's a new whip, and he was specifically elected this time around from the Tea Party wing as the guy who was going to be the Freedom Caucus's seat at the leadership table and represent them. What they failed to take into account was that the whip's job is to whip votes for
sure.
The speaker's agenda.
Is Scalise not loyal to Boehner?
Scalise has turned out, disappointingly to the House Freedom Caucus, Scalise has turned out to be loyal to Boehner, yes.
But he can't get any of his friends on board.
They are disappointed that he has turned out to be loyal to Boehner. They thought he was going to be their representative, not the House whip.
So John Boehner hasn't given a reason, as far as I know. You think his reason is just the same thing that when he used to, I remember after the last government shutdown or almost shut down. That famous photo of him in the elevator just as it's closing, and there are cameras, and his head is against the wall of the elevator in clear mixture of, I don't know, disgust and sheer fatigue dealing with this. You think he's had it, and that's why he's gone.
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, there's really no more that, as he said, I'll use his words, he's accomplished everything that he can accomplish at this particular point in time. There's nothing future on the agenda other than marking time until the presidential election and seeing if we can change the presidency. So with that being the case, he had always intended on retiring last year. The defeat by Dave Brat of Eric Cantor gave him a wake-up call. He changed his mind about retiring. He was going to run for re-election and then resign and let Eric Cantor take over.
But he didn't want to let Steve Scalise.
Steve Scalise was a new guy out of nowhere.
Okay.
You know, he didn't even enter the picture until November.
So is he John Boehner staying in Congress, or is that it? I mean, he's not that old a guy.
No, he's 65 years old,
that's
and he's resigning from Congress.
Look, that's younger than the half the senators, probably more.
He's only 2 years older than I am. He is.
The Senate was at median age is what, 75, I think. So
John Boehner is just an avid golfer, and I hope that he has the chance to practice his hobby on a daily basis.
So we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to know where the Congress goes from here, where the Republican Party, where the House Republicans go from here. Will Kevin McCarthy wins? If he wins, will he be any better at this job than John Boehner? And can we Democrats hope that you continue to fight amongst yourselves, thus giving us the wins that we seem to enjoy, even though we've got a tiny minority in the House of Representatives? Folks, we'll be right back with Mike Lane, my guest, right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Big news rocking Washington, D.C. today. The Speaker of the House is resigning. He's resigning next month. We have a clip of his resignation statement. Let's listen to it.
My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
Sure,
I have to
sing
that on my way to work in the morning. Listen, my mission every day is to fight for a smaller, less costly, and more accountable government. And over the last 5 years, our majority has advanced conservative reforms that will help our children and their children. We're now on track to cut government spending by $2.1 trillion over the next 10 years. We've made the first real entitlement reform in nearly two decades. And we've protected 99% of the American people from an increase in our taxes. And we've done all this with a Democrat in the White House. So I'm proud of what we've accomplished. But more than anything, my first job as Speaker is to protect the institution. A lot of you know that, my plan was to step down at the end of last year. I decided in November of 2010 that when I was elected Speaker that serving two terms would have been plenty. But in June of last year, when it became clear that the majority leader lost his election, I frankly didn't believe it was right for me to leave at the end of last year. So my goal was to leave at the end of this year. So I planned actually on my birthday, November 17th, to announce that I was leaving at the end of the year. But it's become clear to me that this prolonged leadership turmoil would do irreparable harm to the institution. So this morning, I informed my colleagues that I would resign from the speakership and resign from Congress at the end of October. Now, as you've often heard me say, this isn't about me. It's about the people. It's about the institution. Just yesterday, we witnessed the awesome sight of Pope Francis addressing the greatest legislative body in the world. And I hope that we will all heed his call to live by the golden rule. But last night I started to think about this, and this morning I woke up and I said my prayers, as I always do, and I decided, you know, today's the day I'm going to do this. As simple as that.
And he's singing. Mike, he's singing My Oh My, What a Wonderful Day. I feel like he seems like a prisoner released from jail.
I think that's an apt thing. You know, there's a great weight off his shoulders where he no longer has to deal with the pulling tensions and the different directions represented by a wonderfully diverse caucus. And so now it becomes somebody else's responsibility.
Wonderfully diverse caucus. For the record, I'm here with Mike, and it seems like he said that through gritted teeth. Let me ask you, Mike, the big news prior to this retirement was that this wing that you enjoy so much, the Tea Party wing of your party, was going to shut down the government over the funding of Planned Parenthood. And clearly Boehner and Mitch McConnell did not want them to do that. They felt that this would, frankly, help the Democrats if they shut down the government again. And I thought we were going to see another budget pass by your 215 or so with John Boehner and the Democrats, leaving the Tea Party wing out. Where does this battle go from here?
Well, I think that, you know, the Speaker is released from any tensions now that might be generated by the House Freedom Caucus, and it will be his intent, I think, to bring forward a continuing resolution or a budget or whatever process they finally wind up using that will fully fund the government, that will avoid a government shutdown, and we'll move forward from there.
But he only has 215. Will the Freedom Caucus, out of respect for their departing leader, play ball this one time?
No, I think the Democrats will play ball.
Okay, he will do it the way that I was talking about.
Yeah.
So that'll just be one more thing for them to give him a kick on the way out. They won't support him there.
No. You know, they are. It depends on what the final things are. Look, we all know their objective is an admirable, wonderful objective. I don't want to debate Planned Parenthood with you now.
No, we're not going to debate that. But to your party,
There's absolutely no defending this organization in the minds of the House Freedom Caucus and in the minds of most Republicans anyway. So they want to stand on that hill, and we all know that that hill is too soft and quicksand to stand on, that there's no way they're ever going to do it, that the government will shut down, and notwithstanding the fact that we would say it's President Obama's responsibility for shutting down the government, that's not the way the American people are going to see it.
Political battle. You lost it under Newt Gingrich. You lost it under John Boehner.
So why fight a battle that you're not going to win?
So at the end of the day, is this about gerrymandered districts, the fact that the Republicans in the House of Representatives care more about or worry more about being primaried out than they do about the Democrats in their very red districts?
Well, I wouldn't say that this is just a Republican situation. I mean, we have gerrymandered districts around the country, and I think that one of the reasons the middle has disappeared from American politics is because of gerrymandered districts where Democrats, liberals, progressives, Republicans, conservatives, whoever you are more worried about a primary challenge than you are about your general election.
Would you be willing to reach across the aisle and across the table and have nonpartisan commissions designed, as they do in Iowa and a few other states, design the districts all across the country?
Eventually I would, yes. But as long as Republicans control it, no, why am I going to cede that power to you? But when you start winning things and you start getting the advantage
we'll do it under all 50 states.
I'm all over that idea.
We'll do it in all 50 states. To be fair, because you're gerrymandering Virginia while we're gerrymandering Maryland.
You know, I don't want to be fair, Mark. I want to win elections.
Yeah, I understand. You are a Republican. Mike, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to know what the House looks like with Boehner gone. Will Kevin McCarthy become Speaker? If so, will anything change? This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back. Right after. Back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Sitting across from me is Mike Lane, the president of IntelliFence Strategies, Republican strategist. Actually, we're finding a significant amount to agree on, not on ideology to be sure, but on politics and why John Boehner is leaving the House of Representatives. And I figure, who better than a Republican to help, explain what's going on behind the scenes? And then in the last segment, we're going to talk a little bit about Pope Francis and his visit to Washington. But Mike, back to John Boehner. Once he goes, the conventional wisdom is that Kevin McCarthy, congressman from California, will be Speaker. First of all, do you share that conventional wisdom?
I do, but I'm not absolutely certain.
Okay, who would oppose him? Would it be the Tea Party wing, or would it be someone in the middle?
Yeah,
Is there any middle ground, I guess, in the Republican Party between the establishment wing and the Tea Party wing?
I think the Freedom Caucus would be looking for someone that would be acceptable.
They don't call themselves the Tea Party wing?
It's the House Freedom Caucus is what they call themselves.
Okay.
I think they're looking for someone who would be broadly acceptable to the Republican conference, but still come out of the Tea Party wing. You know, I think look at Jeb Hensarling from Texas as being a likely one. Look at, I can't come up with any other names.
Kevin McCarthy is fully in the John Boehner wing of the party.
Kevin McCarthy is establishment, yes.
What is he going to do that John Boehner didn't do? I mean, he can't wave his magic wand and get from 215 to 220, can he?
Well, no. What he'll do is he'll first make a few promises and assurances to the House Freedom Caucus that they will be more influential and more a part of his administration.
Will they be?
In the beginning. Here's the problem the Freedom Caucus has. They're a minority within their own conference. And they're asking for more than their numbers deserve, but yet, proportionality is not it because you can't get to 218 without them. So they do have an outsized influence. I think that that Kevin McCarthy is likely to be it. I think that he has probably, with the promises and assurances he'll make, he'll be able to get to the magic number for election as Speaker. If not, if for some reason there's a revolt against him, I don't think we're going to see somebody from the Tea Party wing come out and be the victor. I think that's when Paul Ryan jumps in and says, okay, if Kevin McCarthy can't get it done, I'm going to try it.
Isn't Paul Ryan, and of course he was the vice presidential candidate with Mitt Romney, isn't Paul Ryan one of the few Republicans that gets along with both sides of that divide, establishment and the Tea Party?
He does. He gets along with everybody, although more recently he's erred on the side of being a Boehner ally, and so therefore he's generated some initial mistrust with the House Freedom Caucus. I don't think that's fatal.
So you don't think he's going to try to run, but if he feels like Kevin McCarthy is in trouble, that's when he'll get in.
Yeah, I think he'll support McCarthy, and he'll only get in if McCarthy can't get the job done.
Now, McCarthy's going to have to use Democrats just like John Boehner did, and
No. See, that's the key thing, is once a change is made, the Freedom Caucus is going to be bought into this, and they're not going to be able to revolt again for at least a year. So
why do you say that? Why not? Because the budget's not due for another year.
Well,
I guess,
but they also get, the new speaker gets a honeymoon with the conference, and the it's just not something they've bought in. If McCarthy gets in there, or whoever gets in there gets in with Freedom Caucus votes, and so they're invested, they're bought in, they can't start being recalcitrant again for a period of time.
Now, 2016 is a presidential election year. It's also the last year of an 8-year presidency. What could possibly get done anyway?
Very little.
Yeah, I mean, Obama is not going to move any. I don't see the Republicans moving any. The way I see it, there'll be very little important legislation until 2017.
Right. I mean, I think we're looking at riders on a continuing resolution or something like that. And McCarthy may decide that to keep the Freedom Caucus on his side, that he's willing to add some more riders rather than the Boehner approach of a clean CR. Now, That'll still be vetoed.
Just one second. CR is a
continuing resolution. Right.
Basically, to keep the government going at the same levels as before.
If you can't get a budget, which we can't get.
I just got, everyone lives in Washington, Mike.
And that's exactly right. I used to coach people on how not to use acronyms, and here I am doing it.
Go ahead. So,
but anyway, if you get a continuing resolution to the president's desk with riders on it that he doesn't like, he will veto it.
Of course he will.
So it's in the middle of a presidential campaign at that point. It doesn't matter who the Republican nominee is. They're going to be privately telephoning the speaker, said, stop this shutdown, get this thing going. So we're really not going to see any mega controversies, I don't think, in 2016.
Now, what's interesting is that this goes on in the House, whereas in the Senate, Mitch McConnell really is from the same establishment wing as John Boehner. He does have a few troublemakers. Ted Cruz comes to mind. Of course, Ted Cruz is running for president, but he's been a troublemaker for quite some time. And frankly, he needs more votes. He needs 60. Is it that in the Senate they understand that you got to get some Democratic votes and they're just more used to it than the House?
No, Ted Cruz has a lot of allies. He's got 5 or 6 people that will vote with him each time, depending on
what
the issue is.
But they're not shutting down the Senate.
They're not shutting down the Senate because they know that they can't get to 60 votes anyway to get past Harry Reid. So they really become grandstanders, and they're irrelevant to the process because Harry Reid's the one who's relevant.
So the Senate is institutionally used to bipartisan compromise in a way that the House is not.
Correct.
Okay. And
absolutely. Remember the old adage, you know, the members of the House, I forget who said
the
this.
The cup and the saucer?
Members of the House would always say, you know, the Democrats, when they were in control for 50 years, would say, no, Republicans are not the enemy. Republicans are the opposition. The Senate is the enemy.
And that's part of the problem. Let's try to tone down the partisanship as we actually talk about after the break. I want to talk about Pope Francis's visit to Washington, D.C., his speech before Congress, and the accusation by some conservatives, Mike, that he is a liberal and that Pope Francis isn't. Rush Limbaugh, for example, specifically condemned the Pope, which I didn't think I would hear that kind of strong accusation. And he's not the only one. There are a number on the right. You are, of course, a practicing Catholic. I suspect you're more charitable than Rush Limbaugh, but then again, 99% of us are. I want to know specifically what you thought about Pope Francis and specifically about the charges that he may just be a progressive. We'll get right back with Mike Lane and his discussion on the Pope's visit right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is Mike Lane. He's a Republican strategist. Mike, Pope Francis had quite a reception here in Washington, D.C., and of course, he's in New York today, and I guess he was in Philadelphia. And I got to tell you, where I sit, he's liberals' favorite pope. I don't agree with him on everything, but I'm a big fan of Pope Francis. I like him much better than Pope Benedict. Of course, I'm not Catholic, but I can still have an opinion. I love that he talks so much about poverty. And I also love, and I think most Catholics seem to love, his demeanor. I mean, the fact that he washed the feet of Muslim prisoners. He truly does seem to practice humility in a way that certainly other popes have not, but certainly seem to be part of Catholic teaching. He does, though, appear to rub some conservatives the wrong way. What were your thoughts?
Well, as far as the religion and the theology and the practicing of Catholicism and the spreading of the word, I believe him to be quite successful, a very holy man, someone who takes seriously his vows of poverty as well as the fact that the church is dedicated and committed towards helping the less fortunate, helping the poor, et cetera. I mean, he
walks the walk.
He's the best visual aspect of that the Catholic Church has had in a long time.
He walks the walk, but he also talks the talk. And in fact, he called capitalism, I believe, the dung of the devil, something like that. Very, very strong words. Certainly, he talked about looking out for Americans that, well, not just Americans, for people, well, he said it in Congress, but looking out for people who go and do their jobs every day and are just trying to make ends meet. Is he persuading people in the Catholic Church? Is he persuading perhaps even some Republicans?
I think that in terms of, and first of all, I can't confirm that quote that you used. I hadn't heard that one, but I wouldn't.
I'll get the exact quote.
That's okay. No problem. But I think he makes a mistake when he condemns our economy and our system of government. It's not something that resonates with people like me. And I'm, as you pointed out to the audience, I'm a practicing Catholic. I attend Mass every week. I live my life according to the tenets of the Church. I understand the beliefs that I have. I've, you know, went to Catholic school as a child, etc. But I get my spiritual and my theological and my moral teachings from the Pope. I don't get my political teachings from the Pope. And I think that he has not in the process of making the mistake, but he has made the mistake of crossing that line and starting to become perhaps a little bit overly activist political, which is not something that's going to capture my attention or people like me.
Just so you know, he quoted a 4th century bishop calling the unfettered pursuit of money
the
dung of the devil. So I want to get the quote exactly.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's been a Catholic teaching for a long time.
It certainly has. I don't think it's anything new. I also think that in his speech to Congress, it was fascinating how much emphasis he put on immigration. Of course, that's been the big issue Donald Trump has taken in the Republican primary. And he reminded us something that I call us Americans, want to remember, which is that we in the United States share America with a whole big continent to the south, where the Pope is from, of course, from Argentina. And he talked about how we share this continent and how the vast majority of us on this continent are immigrants to this continent. That's true both in Argentina and the United States. And he made a fervent plea to recognize that people coming to America are simply trying to live a better life, to live the American dream. He talked about the American dream, and really a strong plea to open our doors. Is this going to push anyone towards immigration reform? I mean, I thought it was very powerful.
You know, this is an interesting dilemma that the Pope has put himself into. If you look at the immigration policies of the Vatican City itself, which is an independent state, they have among the most restrictive immigration policies.
I don't
think
there are any women in the state of Vatican City.
You're not allowed to move. You're not allowed to relocate as a woman to the Vatican City unless you're the wife of a Swiss guard.
But the Vatican City is, an acre? I mean, it's less than a square mile.
That's exactly the point. There are restrictions because
The
Vatican City. No, you don't have to be part of the Catholic Church. But the Vatican City cannot absorb, because of its size, it cannot absorb an unlimited number of immigrants. I would make the same...
the United States is how many millions times the size of Vatican City?
Quite a bit, but that doesn't mean that we can absorb unlimited numbers of immigrants. You want to do it in a controlled manner. You want to do it in a very compassionate manner. There are many, many immigrants who are seeking asylum and who need our help, and we should welcome them with open arms, and we should bring them in, and we should assimilate them into the American culture, and we should give them a new opportunity to get started. But that does not mean unlimited immigration, and I think the Pope misunderstands that just because America is a million or whatever number you want to use times bigger than the Vatican City doesn't mean that our resources are unlimited, and it doesn't mean that our capacity to accept immigrants on an unlimited basis exists. It doesn't.
Well, and we can get to a little bit of debate here. To me, part of what America is all about is the Statue of Liberty, is the poem Emma Lazarus inscribed at the foot of that, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." She didn't say, "Give me your educated, your most talented." She talked about your tired, poor, huddled masses. And as a great-grandchild of one of those tired, poor, huddled masses that came to this country a little over 100 years ago, my great-grandfather had less than $20 to his name. I know that because
that's a lot of money in those days.
I've seen the Ellis Island manifest. If you had $50 or more, you got a check mark. But my great-grandfather only had $20. And yet, I think his family did okay. I think my family's done okay. I think the vast majority of immigrants to America, I don't know when your family came, Mike, but whether it came 100, 200, or 300 years ago, you're the descendant of immigrants as well. Why can't we? It seems to me we still have a very large country. Why can't we take in more immigrants just like we did 100 years ago?
I didn't say we can't take in more. I said we can't take in unlimited numbers. Would you agree with me? Our country's what, 330 million? Would you agree with me that we cannot accept another 150 million immigrants between now and the end of the year?
Okay, that would be impossible.
So now we're arguing over is the numbers. You know, we've agreed that unlimited is not possible. So now we're just arguing over the numbers. I think that, you know, there are limits to what we want to accept in on a time sensitive basis, because we want to have the resources to, number one, grow our economy and make sure these people have the chance to succeed the American dream. And
let me suggest to you that immigrants in the not just the long run, but even in the medium run, help our economy grow. That the reason we are the strongest economy still, China, you're second and you've got a billion more people than we do. The reason we're the strongest economy is precisely because of the creativity and diversity of people from all over the world who come here and make America great. And it's precisely this diversity and creativity from our immigrants that often leads to the best economic successes and grows our economy.
Well, okay. You said in the medium run, we all understand in the short run that that's not necessarily the
case. 5-10 years, it's already true.
But we understand in the short run that's not necessarily the case. Well, the problem is our economy is so flat now that we don't have the resources to do the absorption at the rate, the increased rate that you would like to have. The second thing I would point out on that is that I don't worship at the altar of diversity. Diversity is just something that is or isn't, and it's not something that grows. I'll grant you the creativity thing. I'll grant you the work ambition thing, and I'll grant you the desire to get ahead and things like that and the investment. But diversity is a non sequitur. Why does diversity do anything? Diversity,
well,
either
diversity,
is or isn't. You
diversity
know, it's not,
leads to creativity. I mean, there's a reason why in America we have saunas and Chinese restaurants and jazz music and Tesla. And
you,
I mean,
you know what, Mark? We were a fabulous growing country. Country and economy before we had the diversity. There's no impact of the diversity on that.
Oh, come on. When America was an English colony, we were nowhere near the diversity and creativity than when the Germans came and the Irish came and then every other immigrant
I would suggest we were the greatest country on earth back then, even before the diversity.
Well, I don't know about that. We had slavery then, so I might disagree with you there. Let me just, one of the things you raise, and it's okay to go a little bit off topic. We do that sometimes. You said, you know, that our economy is really struggling. We have unemployment now at about 5%. We have inflation well below 1%. At a time when China and Europe are struggling, America clearly has the best economy in the world. All I can say is thanks, Obama.
We have the least worst economy in the world.
We do. We have the least worst economy in the world. I think that's pretty good.
You know, even Obama can't keep the economy down forever, although he's tried for 7 years. Now,
Mitt Romney promised that we'd have an unemployment down to 6% by 2016.
Right.
It's down to 5% by 2015. Right. Again, thanks, Obama.
But as you know, the real rate is the U6 rate. It's not the unemployment rate because that's manipulated and things like that. The U6 rate is still over 11%, and that's absolutely anemic, and it's unacceptable.
You're always going to find something to complain about. But I remember Ronald Reagan debating Jimmy Carter and talking about what he called the misery index, which is the unemployment rate plus the inflation rate. And I dare say the misery index is lower now than at any time, maybe in American history.
Well,
least in the last 100 years since we've kept these records. Again, all I can say is thanks, Obama.
Yeah, thanks for the U6 over 11%. Mark, somebody who used to make $120,000 a year getting a part-time job for $28,000 a year, that counts as employment in Obama's world. It doesn't count as employment in my world.
You're right that working class people are still struggling. You're absolutely right about that. Pope Francis is right about that. President Obama is right about that. It's just that every time we try to do things like, I don't know, Hillary Clinton's plan, debt-free college, to make it easier for people to achieve the middle class, the upper middle class,
okay.
Your party's always opposing it.
And we're $17, $18 trillion in debt. We're running annual deficits close to $1 trillion, and now we're going to give away free college to everyone.
We're down to $500 billion, Mike. We were at over $1 trillion under your president, George Bush. We're under half a trillion now. Again,
it was $1.4 trillion under Obama, and I grant you
that was Bush's last year.
I grant you that with sequestration, which is not the best way to do it, we have gotten it down to about $600 billion. But if you look at the projections, it's going up starting next year. We have hit the trough, and we're about to launch again.
Folks, I did have to show you that Mike is indeed a Republican, so we had to get a little bit of that in. Let me just ask you this: we only got about a minute left. As a Catholic, were you very proud of the Pope? I mean, I was very proud of the moment, and of course, I'm not Catholic. I found it very meaningful. How did it strike you?
I was happy he came here. I was elated to see him address a joint session of Congress, no matter what his message was. But he had a lot of different messages, and it wasn't just the environment, economic poor thing. And I'm fully on board with the poor thing, although I would have different solutions than him. Let's also remember that after the president lectured the Pope on religious freedom, the Pope added an unscheduled trip to the headquarters of the Little Sisters of the Poor just to rub it in Obama's eye and say, you know what, we're not letting you get away with that, you liar.
I don't think Pope Francis would have used that language.
He wouldn't
have. I think
have.
It's fair to say that he has a little bit more tact, perhaps, than you. But that's why I guess I like having you here. Thank you for sharing this Friday with us. And we'll have to bring you back at a time when we have more time and people can call in, because I know that some of my listeners would love to ask you some tough questions.
I look forward to it.
This is Mark Levine. I want everyone to have a very pleasant weekend. We'll be back on Monday with more of the Inside Scoop. Follow me on Twitter @MarkLevineTalk. This is Mark signing off.